You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Speaking here, you're listening to episode 82 of the See Here podcast. We talk about music related films. That's our job, that's our role, that is what we do. You're listening to me on my lovely new AKG Lyra microphone. Very, very sexy. I'm rather quite pleased with this. And over in Bath is my friend and esteemed colleague, Mr. Bernard Stickwell.
Hello.
Once again, our other esteemed colleague and great friend, Mr. Tim Merrill, is not available, but I can promise you that he will be back next month. We'll talk a bit about that at the end of the show. So you might be wondering, what have we got up for you? Well, we've just done an interview with a fellow called Colm Ford, and he is the curator, and he started out this music festival in London called Dock and Roll, and it's also a VOD service, and all they do is music documentaries. So we were made for each other. Our podcast, his music festival, we thought we had to talk to him. So in a minute or two, we will present that interview for you for your listening pleasure. After that, we'll be back to talk about what will be on next month and about Tim, the prodigal son, returning back to the show after a few months.
The second coming, and more anticipated than the second Stone Roses album.
Oh, well, hang on. The second Stone Roses album didn't tend to go anywhere that was satisfactory for most fans, did it?
Yeah, but it was highly anticipated. Hopefully Tim will buck that trend. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
The true second coming.
We'll be back after this break with our interview with Colm Ford. You're listening to See Here, episode 82.
To define myself,
I think extraordinary.
An explosion
from another planet.
Mysterious, unknowable.
They just rock.
Times have changed.
I gotta figure out what to do.
This is the end of everything that starts.
We're family, so, you know, there's nothing that's gonna destroy that.
Playing music, I love it.
Punk and DIY punk.
A different level of feeling.
Bigger than one human being.
What we're doing is really healthy.
It's about celebrate.
A kind of spiritual anarchy.
Nobody is the president.
And that is where great music exists.
Hey man, this is tripping me out.
Who's that?
Welcome back to episode 82 of See Here podcast. And Bernie and I have got on the Skypes, I guess, the curator, the originator of a film festival that started in London about 7 or 8 years ago, I think, called Dock and Roll. Welcome to the show, Colm Ford.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being had. We've had many a director on the show before, but I think this is the first time that we've had someone who's run a festival, a music film festival. I mean, this is right up our alley. We do music-related films on this podcast, so the fact that you existed meant that we just had to reach out to you. How did you come up with an idea to actually run a music documentary festival?
Well, it started back in 2013 when I arrived in London from Dublin, where I'm from, and I was just looking for a change of scene. I've been working in Dublin as a film archivist restoration post-production ahead for like 10 years. So I just jumped ship on that, and I was looking for a similar type of job, but in the archive collections, museum collections and that in London in 2013. And it wasn't a great time to be looking for public service jobs. All of these jobs are kind of paid for by the public purse, so major cutbacks in that scene. So I was kind of at a loose end and reluctant to go into professional post-production. I just was a little long in the tooth for that. So I just decided to put kind of my twin loves of alternative documentary or indie film plus alternative music to good use, and to give some, basically some joy to these films that normally would only get a London premiere if they're lucky and be forced straight to DVD, and they wouldn't get any type of screening outside of the capital. So we, myself, my partner Vanessa, did couple of months research to figure out if there was a market there and how we could access it, and we threw ourselves into it because it was a bit of a gamble, to say the least, because we had zero contacts in the art scene in the UK and had no prior experience of screening a film anywhere or organising anything beyond a dinner party at home. So it was a shot in the dark. It took a while to get going. It took a good 2 years, two editions, to gain some traction and to spread from our initial one cinema in Hackney to now last year 9 cinemas across London. So yeah, we just kind of dove into it with a combined passion of just like alternative music from all the spectrums, from jazz all the way across to metal and everything in between, you know.
Now, I know that here in Melbourne every year for the Melbourne International Film Festival, they always get someone to curate a subsection devoted to music documentaries for as part of MIF. Has the BFI done anything similar like that?
Yeah, they actually had a thing called Sonic Cinema, I think, for their London Film Festival. But that's a mixture of short films and dramatic films, fiction films, and some music docs as well. So it's got a mixed bag of about 7 or 8 titles. And yeah, we were aware of them being on the scene, but you know, they're a whole other sphere, to say the least. Having said that, we opened our third edition of our festival in the BFI South Bank Cinema, so that was a nice little leg up we got from them. We opened with the film on Gregory Porter, their world premiere of the film of The Jazz Singer, and had a great double Q&A, sold out double screen one, sold out opening night, so that was great. But the BFIs, yeah, obviously they have their eye on, I think, 200 films over that festival, so you know, it's only a small part of the overall thing that they do, and weakens a lot of these festivals around us that existed before we started. They always had 7 to 8 films, you know, with premieres, and we've just kind of pulled the carpet from under them on that because of our growing in strength. So Raindance, Sheffield, Glasgow Film Festival, Edinburgh, Cambridge, they've all been hit drastically by us stealing their UK premieres. So, you know, we've made friends and enemies to our success.
It's the enemies that lets you know that you've become successful.
Absolutely, yeah. It took me a while to understand that, yeah, but definitely. I never actually had any enemies that I was aware of prior to doing this, so they came quick and fast. They came quick and fast on the third edition when you started to screen at like 4 or 5 cinemas across London, and we broke out of London into Brighton and Liverpool initially. So now we have 14 city editions outside of London, so yeah. They're disgruntled, you know, ruffled a lot of feathers in the established dinosaur scene of festival booking.
It's a cutthroat business, isn't it?
Oh, man, it is, to get your hands on premieres, yeah. If you don't have a premiere, you get no press. So that's the end of the story on that. You know, we learned the hard way, you know. And obviously, our enemies, some of them are now working with us. So keep them close. A lot of the cinemas that we started out with, they themselves would have had programmed, you know, music docs across there. Maybe some of them have like 25. Different branches across the UK, and they would have had regular music documentaries, maybe not as left field of stuff as we program, but they would have had stuff not in a regular strand, but they program now and again. So they themselves, you know, were eyeing us up and started to take our programming and throw it across their branches. So we, you know, our own success started to cannibalize our program, our own partners. So, you know, it's definitely cutthroat, you know.
Has Dock and Roll been able to provide grants for filmmakers, or is it purely just about giving them an exhibition leg up?
No, unfortunately, we don't have anywhere near that kind of funding or anything in that realm. Like, I mean, that type of funding usually is, comes from a public body, and we'd be facilitated by a festival, but we don't have that kind of public funding, you know, like the other bigger ones would have, like Sheffield Dockfest or Edinburgh or the BFI themselves, which is all lottery money at the end of the day. It's all comes from the same public purse, you know. So, but we are nowhere near established in that front. Like, we're only having our 8th edition next November. So those that hand out those kind of grants would be at least 20 years old in their being established, you know. No, so we just kicked the door open for a lot of left of field filmmakers. Most of them are first time filmmakers. A vast majority, I'd say about 85% of them that we deal with. We're dealing with bigger directors now in the last three or four years. But initially, in the first 3 or 4 years, we're dealing mostly with first time filmmakers who didn't really know to navigate this scenario, and we didn't either, so we kind of learned with them and held our hand a little bit and opened opportunities for them across outside of London. So basically why we set this up was to make sure there was a kind of a social element and a like-minded gathering of freaks and misfits and all sorts of music nerds who come together and meet outside of their home rather than being stuck at home as we are nowadays, watching stuff online, you know, watching you know, VOD versions of these films. So basically to give these films a proper airing as they should be in a Dolby system, like with a big screen, you know. And we've definitely been successful in that. Hasn't been easy, but the directors we've dealt with and we've reached out to and we've screened, they've been really appreciative of what we've put together. Because previously, like I said, at the initial opening, they might have gotten their foot in the door with one screening in London if they were lucky. And that would be just the beginning end of it, because those festivals couldn't give a damn about giving any life or legs to these films. It's just in and out. They're the program. They fuck off. See you later. Bye. Whatever. They couldn't even be bothered answering any further questions as to help these people get in elsewhere, anywhere else. My whole thing of approaching directors is to gain a bit of rapport with them, sit in a Skype with them for 40 minutes or an hour and win them over 7 or 8 months before we're screening with them, to make sure that we have given them a good reason to come with us rather than to go with any old other better established festival with a strand of 4 or 5 films that I'll just say you're going to get lost in the program. And these people wouldn't even bother sitting with you for half an hour and getting to know you even for that minute. You know, so we've always had a long vision in this in terms of the value of giving our own time, spending, you know, long hours during the week and weekends in like making contact with these filmmakers, and also for the long tail of them putting us in touch with their mates who they meet at other festivals, and they're all just to kind of, you know, spread the word, and they themselves coming back with other films 3 or 4 years after that, you know. So we have over the years, like after I think I'm year four, we started to do semi-theatrical across UK and Ireland, which meant that we weren't just screening at our festivals, which at that stage was London plus 5 or 6 other UK city festivals, but we were also screening outside of that at maybe 7 or 8 other cinemas that had gained our confidence and were happy for us to do some minor distribution with them. Since we did that, now we're doing kind of bigger theatrical distribution in the realm of 50 to 75 screens for certain documentaries, about 3 or 4 per year. So it's kind of grown out of that, you know. And now we have a VOD service as well with 40 docs on it that is globally available on demand. So, you know, that itself as well, you know, it kind of all grew little by little, struggle by struggle over 7 years, you know.
The whole reason for me starting this band was because I was fucking bored being lied to.
Is anyone tired? Is anyone fucking tired?
After all these years in rock and roll, all we needed was brutal honesty from an angry-looking man in Bristol.
As you progressed over the years and as the name's gotten a little bigger and the festival's gotten a little bigger, have you found more directors and filmmakers have actually been approaching you? Or do you find that you're still having to really search out and dig? Or is it a combination of both still?
Yeah, it's still a combination of both, but, you know, the ratio has shifted massively where, you know, for the first 2 years, we didn't have Film Freeway or any other platform to submit to. And I was just literally, most of my work was involved in scouring the internet, Facebook, particularly for these films up and coming, that Facebook pages hitting people up and just doing a lot of research across other festivals to kind of pick and choose bits and pieces of data that other festivals would be showing and to put them all together. But we launched our Film Freeway page probably on the 3rd of and did okay on that, got about 60 submissions for features. I was probably like still me 70% of the time looking for these films and 30% input coming into us. And yeah, it's just like a word of mouth thing. Now we have had, we're really strong now with Film Freeway. We had 121 feature submissions last year and 85 the year before, and then 70 odd shorts, 70 and 80 shorts around that. And these days I'd probably be chasing myself about 20% of the program and 80% coming in at me, which is great. So at least, so obviously the chasing involves the bigger films now, particularly, you know, and winning those directors and producers over as to why they should screen those over others. No, and that, you know, keeps it interesting, you know. It's great to see it evolving, and it's always a challenge still to try and win these producers over, you know, when they don't see the profile being worthwhile versus what they can get out of another festival. So it's all about that charm and kind of win, just, you know, laying it up, going, look, you can screen with these guys, but that's the end of your story. You're not going to travel anywhere. We can offer you like 17, 18, 20 screenings if you come with us, you know. So that's one of the main reasons why the festivals hate us, you know, because they can't do that. They couldn't be bothered doing that. But they won't try and challenge us on it. They just hate us for it, you know what I mean? Rather than them rolling their sleeves up themselves and going out and doing it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They just really hate the fact that we have this niche, and it totally undermines their whole program now in that section that they were extremely comfortable in, because they can't fight back, because this couldn't be bothered on one hand, and the heads of those festivals don't see the value in it. So it's a win-win for us, you know?
Yeah, and that's their problem, isn't it? If they're not prepared to actually, like you say, roll their sleeves up and do some work, then the space was wide open for you to step in and do it, wasn't it? So
absolutely, it's their problem. Yeah. But you know, it's just, you know, the grudgery is endless. You know, you'll find it wherever you look.
Yeah,
you know, so that's that kind of silliness that keeps us going sometimes as well. You know, you always need to have somebody to kick against. You know, you need to have your nemesis, otherwise, you lose the fun aspect of it all.
It's too easy.
Exactly. And that's what these people are suffering from, because they never have a challenge. And in the vast majority of cases, they're working for somebody else who doesn't give a damn, whereas we're working for ourselves. And obviously,
we do. Yeah.
That's their frustration from being trapped in that scenario where they really want to put it up against us, but those above them don't see the purpose or the reason to do so. But, you know, we were quite happy where we are. We always had planned to do some online elements, but it's obviously taken a whole other priority now in the last year with the closures. But
I was going to ask you about that.
We set out to maintain and to bring people together with after parties and, you know, DJ sets and kind of local gigs associated with the theme of the films and all of that. But inevitably, we had a lot of people coming at us going, listen, how can I see that film you showed last year or 2 years ago? I can't find it anywhere. And in most cases, I know that they're available, but the people who are asking me are just haven't bothered looking at probably Google for long enough to find what they're looking for. And they don't know the title and that kind of thing. So we knew it was inevitable that we'd set up some elements of online. So it was like, it was a bit of a no-brainer to kind of facilitate those people, particularly the big fans in the cities that we reach to who can't come to see everything, because some of our programs in London particular, like we'd have 31 or 2 features every November for our headline festival. So you can only see 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 maximum a day of those films if you're a super fan. So it's like great to be able to set up this channel that it would facilitate people who just, you know, have that enthusiasm but obviously can't see everything in our program, you know. You know, we always set it up as a slow burn in the background, you know, but we actually had set it up a year and a half ago. So it was good that prior to COVID, we already had 12 films up there available, you know.
Yeah, you find that interest in the Dock and Roll TV has just spiked massively in the last year then, or...
Yeah, well, it's a grower as well, because like I said, we set it up there in the background and we don't have much marketing behind it. Our biggest expense, any festival's biggest expense, is marketing and PR, you know? So it's the biggest, largest chunk of our budget for our festivals is marketing. And we had nothing for the TVOD really, because we had to concentrate on the live aspect. You know, that's where it went. And we were going to word of mouth it all the way through our 14 city branches and work it that way, you know, and let that kind of groundswell over 2 years build it. But obviously we couldn't do that when COVID hit, and that was, we hadn't done anything beyond social push on it, newsletter push. So we obviously reorientated our funds and started and put some PR publicity behind Dock and Roll TV while we added another 20 something titles to it over the summer. So around April we started pushing it hard, and we had 12 titles on it, were UK and Ireland only. And then we opened up the rest of our acquisitions to worldwide, which really helped. Because funnily enough, we have like a lot of people reading our newsletter in the States for some reason, even though we've never done any public screenings there. So we're pulling like viewers from the US for documentaries that are available in the US and other platforms, which I'm quite happy and proud about. That's kind of bizarre, but we obviously built a kind of a reputation amongst these Uber fans of music that worth checking out. And once we are able to offer them something online, they snapped it up. It's great. And now we're reaching 26 countries. So that's kind of funny.
That's incredible, isn't it? That's really good.
Got lots of random stuff. You know, we've obviously got, you know, our biggest would be UK. And then we've got Germany, Australia, France, US, Canada, maybe the biggest, and then some Scandinavian, and then just oddball stuff like Lithuania, Latvia, and like, you know, all random Croatia, whatever. No, it's like really funny. It's kind of interesting to see how far we've reached with. So one of the funny things is that as well, that vast majority of our program is available elsewhere. We only have an exclusive on one title at the moment out of 40. So these are widely available, maybe widely available is an exaggeration, but they're available on several platforms in these people's home countries, but they just don't know about them, you know.
Well, I guess the fact you have them all in one spot as well totally helps, doesn't it? You know, you come on board to find one thing and find 15 other things that you're interested in, you know. So
that's it. Like, but the problem with this kind of structure is that because we're pay as you go and like on demand, you have to continually remind people that you exist, and that's the biggest expense involved. TVOD, you know, transactional VOD rather than subscription VOD, because once you have somebody's credit card details and a monthly subscription, generally people forget to unsubscribe, even though they're not watching the content, which is a constant earner for you. But when you come out from the other side of things, which is pretty cheap to set up, the biggest expense is continually reminding people that you exist or trying to find a newer audience, which costs a lot of money, you know, a lot of expense. So we got some really good coverage in April last year across NME and Time Out London. We got into the BFI's magazine Sight and Sound, which is a really cool, and that really kind of grew our fan base. And then we got covered by Italian and French publicity as well, which is surprising.
That's me, Stefan. I spent my childhood between mixing desk and manure. Our farm was always chock full of musicians. The music they recorded is the soundtrack of my youth, and my father the conductor.
Let's talk a little bit about the films themselves. One thing that Bernie and myself and our compadre Tim, who is just on a bit of a break at the moment, but one thing that we always discovered over the last few years is that music documentaries seem to just be exploding. I mean, yeah, we sort of remember back to the 70s and, you know, the music documentaries would be focused then, or the 70s or the 80s, I should say, would be focused on whatever the big studios would want to look at. It might be like Dylan and the Band or the Rolling Stones, God knows how many documentaries about them there are. But like now, with the last 20, 30 years, with technology being so much cheaper, and maybe the history of contemporary music has gotten a lot older, so there's a lot more subject ground to cover. But, you know, we've found that there've been some really fantastic documentaries that sort of go through wider ground. It's not just about the music. So like we did this film, Two Train Running, which had a wider story about the civil rights movement as well as music. The Devil and Daniel Johnson, which was about mental health. And looking on your channel, you've got films like Boom For Real about Jean-Michel Basquiat. So looking about the New York art scene and the ambiguity of David Thomas Broughton about experimentality and Rockable, which I think that might even be an Australian directed film.
About the difficulties
of being a metal band in Afghanistan under Taliban rules.
We are using our music. We just want to play in front of thousands of guys and girls who come together. They cheer and say, yeah, this is true, this works, and we have this kind of idea too.
So you're seeing wider stories rather than just a biography of a particular band. So I guess a rather long-winded way of sort of like asking, what do you specifically look for in a film? I mean, you went and said that you had last year 121 submissions and you obviously couldn't take them all. So what were you looking for?
Oh, it's a combination of many things. But yeah, you're right. There has been an explosion. That's why we exist and why we set it was easy for us to set ourselves up 7 years ago, 8 years ago, because of the content that was coming out. One thing, I think one of the key things there is, like, you know, the cheaper technology, but also the platforms, funding platforms, you know. Mm-hmm. So the vast majority of our elections that come into us are from crowdfunded platforms, from Indiegogo or Kickstarter, you know. Mm-hmm. With that revolution, these filmmakers would never get a chance to make their films because, by and large, like I said earlier, they're first-time filmmakers. They're more like Uber fans with access, or these people who just happen to have access for one reason or another. But they would never get funded by the funding bodies like IDFA or IDA or Sundance Institute. They wouldn't have a hope in hell. Like, it's like, forget about it, you know? By the way, the only thing they're getting bloody funded by those type of sources these days, like the Grierson Trust, it's just issues to it LGTB, which is great, you know, fair enough. Politics, in terms of the crazy scenario we're in at the world at the moment, in terms of ridiculous political sphere we're in, and environmental collapse of the planet. Those three things, that's it, end of story, you know. So even now, it's quite difficult to get funded outside of the realm of these Kickstarters and Indiegogos and that. So that revolution really opened the floodgates, you know, for better or worse, because obviously there's a lot of access and filmmakers making films that are actually rubbish, like, you know, and then a decent filmmaker won't touch that subject again because they just will never get funded beyond it, you know. So it has its pros and cons, but they're mostly pros in terms of allowing these people, you know, to follow their passion, to remortgage their house, sell their car and all the rest, to make a film over 8-10 years at their favorite scene or in their favorite town or whatever, you know. It's like that kind of thing. So what we look for generally is, because what I mentioned previously is our biggest expense in marketing, so we need to have a film that already has a grassroots following somewhere online. That's one thing, apart from the obvious intrigue in the central character or central scene, the ability to tell a story well in ideally under 85 minutes. I have a massive aversion to films that have to go over 90 minutes to tell the story, because I'm saying, God damn, great story, great access. But why do, you know, if you can't tell a story in 90 minutes, you're just a shit storyteller, you know? You don't know how to edit your story, right? You're just a fucking long-winded fart, you know? Fuck off. So to keep the shit for the extras, man, there's so much bullshit out there where they go into like 2 hours and 2 hours, 5 minutes. So for me, it has to appeal, which is a tangent off that. The film has to appeal beyond the central focus of that music scene or music fan base as well, you know? Which is why I'm continually, repeatedly telling people, just can you slim your film down and keep those really nerdy bits for the extras, that, because in general, you're really cutting off your fan base by, you know, expanding the story to cover every goddamn band member that ever existed in the band, or every album and remix that was made of every track. So it's got to be focused, you know, and it's got to have a good structure that, you know, you can leave people wanting more rather than flooding them with information and just kind of going with so much filler, you know. So it's a bit structure, really, being able to tell a good story, and in hopefully got to be in a cinematic angle on it. Can't be just fly on the wall stuff that just doesn't have a good sound mix and doesn't have a potential for it to be really come to life on a big screen or a good sound system, which the ability we have now in the online scene and these hybrid festivals and doing a live and online version has opened us up to showing films that we couldn't show before. So we can show those non-cinematic films that just never had the budget to do good sound mix and all the rest. We can actually facilitate that stuff now, so, which was quite frustrating sometimes 4 or 5 years ago when we didn't have that, where some films are great, but they just didn't have enough finance behind them or enough intelligence in terms of favors being pulled left, right and center to get good sound mixes in for them to justify them to be in a cinema. But we need some kind of fan base on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter that we can leverage into our own socials and boost the awareness of the film beyond that, like, because it's very difficult to start with a film with no awareness anywhere, because essentially you just have to pay for that marketing out there and it becomes a self-defeating thing. You can't spend like 300-500 per film when you're only making that or less than that on the box office. So it's that kind of thing, you know. It has to be a combination of those things, intriguing, not too left of field, you know, left of field, but some connection working with some mainstream artist somewhere along the line in their collaborations or that kind of thing. You know, we can work with films that are really left of field if they have a strong grassroots following on Facebook already, 3,000 or 4,000 followers, that kind of thing.
I don't know whether you get this sort of feedback, but do you find that you get audiences for some films where the music has no appeal to that audience at all, but they find the story intriguing? So, like, for instance, I noted that one of your films is The Allens, One Hell of a Family.
Everybody knew where the stone was. They were coming from Canada. You don't want people to come from Canada and piss on shit all over your grave.
About G.G. Allen's family. I mean, I think the first film that we ever covered on this podcast was Hated, the G.G. Allen story. His music is not my thing. I hadn't even heard of him before we covered it. And yeah, that's going back like 8 years ago or something like that. But I found his story absolutely fascinating. Are you finding that people contacting you and saying, I had no idea who G.G. Allen was, or I have no idea who Jean-Michel Basquiat is, but I find this a really fascinating story? Does story override the fan base of the music?
Yeah, not to the extent that we hoped it would, because we're finding frustratingly more so in the initial years change a little bit as our fan base and our audience has grown in size and breadth. But yeah, we do get a lot of people coming up to us, and usually it's directly after the film, or maybe on Twitter or Instagram within 24 hours of seeing the film. Yeah, they come and go, wow, my mate invited me along to this. I don't like this music scene at all, but I found that really intriguing. Like, yeah, stuff like Connie Plank, Potential and Noise. Like, you know, I mean, it's a film about a producer of mid to late 70s, like left to field Kraftwerk, Noi, and all of that stuff that became more popular with Eurythmics and that kind of thing. But like, just kind of oddball stuff that they themselves would not see on the radar at all, never listen to on the radio or anything. That is an element that I'd hoped would have been stronger in the early days, but it's definitely showing its head now. We discovered, to our surprise or to our ignorance, that a lot of fans are just, they just don't give a damn, you know. They just want to know, want to see the film about their favorite rock artist, and that's the end of the story, you know. And that would probably have been about 80% of our audience 4 or 5 years ago. And very difficult to get them to cross over into other things that we're showing, because we were trying to build a brand and a reputation for, to take a risk on what we're showing. You don't know anything about it, that because of the pedigree of our previous curations, that, you know, be worth taking the gamble on. So that has been taking us longer to achieve than we thought, but thankfully it's taking shape now, where we're probably looking at 50-50 on that now in terms of our audience. 50% of our audience are willing to go with us and take gambles on our program. And as our program has become broader as well, like, because initially we started out just showing kind of alternative rock, punk, bit of hip hop and bits and pieces, but we've gone over the 7 years right into jazz and extreme metal and all sorts of, like, you know, house, techno, everything electronic and that. So it's been interesting, but it's been a slower take up than we thought on that front. But I'm glad to say that that is taking shape.
Do you think that's because younger people's taste in music is changing? Morris and I are old farts. We've been around long enough that when we were younger, we kind of remember it. It was kind of youth tribes. You were either a punk or you were a goth, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas
yeah,
it seems that young people nowadays, because of the ubiquity of music on the internet, on social media, it seems that younger people have just a much broader taste in music. So is that feeding, yeah, into it, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say there's definitely an element of that there. But I would say probably what happened with us initially, our audience was slightly older than that to begin with, but it's become younger over, yeah, the last 3 to 4 years, which I'm very happy to say, because I'd say our average age when we started out 7 years ago was probably about 40. And it, like, you know, obviously we'd have, yeah, the odd teenagers and the odd ones in their early 20s or late 20s, but the vast majority was like 40 to 60, which has a lot to do with, like, the history of music coming of age around that, like, you know, in terms of the stories like Morris was explaining in terms of the appeal of these films. But yeah, I'd say that definitely has shown its head in the last 3 years. A younger audience that we're continually trying to reach are hearing about us and are coming and do have a broader taste, like you mentioned. Absolutely. Yeah. I think they can kind of connect the dots out there now much easier than we,
sure,
could,
yeah,
you know? Because, you know, I myself, I'm in my 40s. I would have loved to have had the access that people have now in the last 10 years to all of these genres of music, because I was hearing stuff when I was 16 and going, I'm never hearing anything like that again for about 4 years until I hit, yep, that scene in Dublin and be able to access, like, interesting you know, Chicago House, that kind of thing. Like, I hear like one Chicago House track in, like, when I was 16 and nothing, and it took me 4 years to find a venue playing that music. You know, it's like, the kind of envy I have of everything being at their fingertips now. Of course, there's a mountain of noise out there obscuring it as well. But you know how it was. I mean, you got very little cash when you're a teenager. You got a part-time job and you're buying a CD, and the CD's got to fucking last you 2 months at least, you know. So
it's that's like, right, yeah.
You know, that was very frustrating for me, you know, because I knew, you know, you find your tribe eventually. About my tribe was always pretty more open, because I was always initially into a bit of everything, alternative rock. You know, I came up under Nirvana and all of that, like, you know, and then a bit of this and that. But like, I always had a taste for electronic music as well, because I came up under that around the 90s, the mid 90s as well. Being able to access all that music, though, I could only afford the, you know, to buy the, you know, Ill Communication and not take a chance on the Left of Field Techno album.
I remember those days well. Yeah, exactly the same.
It's just this massively hit, to say the least, the pockets of the creators, but it's incredible to have that access now, and it definitely is filtering through, and it is supporting our whole kind of thing of reaching these new, younger audiences. Because actually, one of the key points of BFI funding that we get to do the regional tours, so we don't get any funding for London because it's considered to be overfunded and spoiled rotten, which is a bit of an overstatement in terms of the titles that we screen. But we get funding to tour to the UK cities outside of London, and one of the priorities is reaching younger audiences to backfill. The key audiences for alternative independent cinema now is the typical, you know, mid-40s to mid-60s. And there's a crisis there, you know, with the online access of backfilling and reaching the 19 to 23-year-olds and getting them into the cinema, while cinema still exists. That was before COVID hit. So, you know, that's a critical thing as well. Like, I mean, that's a fundamental drive of making sure that there's an audience there for alternative art-house cinema in 15 years' time, to make sure you try and get and grab the 20-year-old now, you know. And that's making it easier for us for that reason, that, like you said, there is access to that music to make the connections, connect the dots, and see that a lot of these genres overlap in terms of, maybe not on first look, but definitely from the production side of thing, and the producers are working on the albums and their own breadth of taste and influence, and how they can make a great album because they have that breadth of influence from other genres. Younger people are seeing those dots, whereas the 50-year-olds couldn't be bothered, you know, aren't interested, more blinkered, you know. That would be good kind of analysis of our audience, where we're looking 50-50 now on that.
You mentioned COVID. Do you have any plans post-COVID? Let's say 2021, we know there's not going to be any magic formula despite the vaccine rollout. This is going to be with us for a few years. But let's say some things return to some level of normality in 2021 or post-2021. What are the plans cinematically for Dock and Roll, ideally, if everything was available to you?
We were on the cusp of a 14-city UK tour in March. We'd already spent our PR funding on the first four cities of that four-month tour. That was 95 screenings booked and confirmed across 14 cities across 4 months. That was disastrous for us for that to be cancelled when we'd already spent doing the marketing of the first four cities. Mm. Like, I mean, we're determined to resurrect that and make sure that we can continue to build on those cities that we'd only recently visited. We have a core base on probably seven cities, and then we were reaching another seven that we'd only started to reach out to do little bits and pieces with. But it's key for us to maintain the social structure of what we set up and make sure that these live events continue to happen. And now, obviously, we'll have a tandem of the online thing always now from now on. But we're determined to get back out there. And I don't want to make a big deal of it, but, like, you know, cinemas are struggling even when they're open these days for content, you know, because the distributors are holding back their medium to large films. Like, so I think it's critical that even in our smaller way, we can bring content to these more obscure towns and cities with interesting cinemas that are on their knees now, with don't have the content to screen, even when they can can find a window within the COVID scenario to screen again. So another thing which is drastic on the horizon is the collapse of these 200 odd independent cinemas across the UK that the BFI has now restructured all its funding to save. Like, so we don't have any touring funding at the moment because of it being reorientated to save the cinemas, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. So in the initial moment, these next 7 or 8 months, but we're determined to get back out there and expand our physical reach to as many cities and towns that will take us, because we, even just with that structure that we'd reached 7 to 8, 10 cities 2 years ago, we had started, like I mentioned, to do semi-theatrical. So we will continue on the back of that to reach more cities, not in our physical kind of 4-day, 5-day festival with lots of Q&As and all that, but at least get the films out there to their audiences as a distributor, you know? So we've obviously expanded our different income streams by a little over the 3 or 4 years. So we are now focused on making sure we distribute 3 to 4 films per year. For obvious financial reasons, but also to help filmmakers out who aren't getting any interest from larger distributors, you know, and are falling between the gaps. So we see there's a market there as well. And obviously to build Docromol TV from its current 40 titles up to something in the region of 65 or 70, you know, over the next 2 years. And also to reorganize the whole structure of our Docromol TV offer, because at the moment it's in a really beta mode. It doesn't have any, it's very basic. Like, you know, we want to build on that and reorganize the site so that we have like a really easy to use platform, easier to navigate, rather than it's a bit of crate digging at the moment. There's no Sean, it's not subdivided by anything, to say the least. So we thought it was most important to get it out there, set it up over the last year, and we'll deal with all those restructuring when we have a little bit more time and income on our hands to actually do it and finesse the site, you know. But we also screen across EU festivals at the moment, that we help our directors who come to us and we screen with them. We offer them access to all our network across the EU and across the States as well, and South America that we have contacts with, but primarily across European festivals that we have mates in and collaborators with, you know, the acquaintances of, you know, between, you know, CPH Docs and Rotterdam and all those kind of festivals that have these alternative music strands within them. We've built camaraderie and that kind of thing between them. So that's what we're determined to do. It's on 3 or 4 different fronts there, but we're determined to make sure that we, if the cinemas exist in a year's time, but we'll be there in the UK to support them, like in Glasgow and Manchester and Bristol and Sheffield, Leeds, you know, and some of the more left of field towns like Reading and Exeter and smaller population towns. So yeah, it's just onwards, you know, as far as we can survive, you know, because we look like, I'm just happy to be able to be talking to you about this now as an ongoing concern, because last May it looked like we were going to have to pull the plug on everything, you know. Wow. It just, wow. Yeah. 95 screenings, like a serious thing, you know. I mean, I know we're all in the same boat here. I mean, theater's fucked, comedy's fucked, like, you know, to everyone, the small music promoters who we have a lot of mates in that world are completely screwed, you know, because these venues, particularly the live music venues, already had economic incentive of all their building construction, development going on around them, shutting down venues because of noise pollution, all this kind of bullshit to deal with before they had COVID, you know, and now they're just absolutely on their knees. So I'm obviously very concerned of where the general arts market's going to be in 12 months' time at all, let alone our small little niche, you know.
For any of our listeners who've been listening to this conversation and think, all right, I think I'm going to go check out that Dock and Roll website. I want to subscribe to something VOD. And as you say, that's worldwide. That's not geo-blocked. So thank goodness for that. Someone comes along and says, right, I've listened to that interview. I'm going to go search out that website. Name me 2 or 3 of your favorites. And I know that you're behind this website. They're like all your babies. But what would be 2 or 3 films that have absolutely knocked you out? Let's say over the last 12 months, a couple of films that you could recommend.
L7 is one of my top 5 anyway of my favorite music docs. Pretend We're Dead, about the grunge band from like 91, 92, 93. It's a great story of vitality and determination, resilience from these 4 women who came up in the shadow of Nirvana and were hanging out mates with all of that grunge scene at the time.
People assume that you're raking in the cash if you're on the cover of Spin magazine, but unless you sell an insane amount of records, you're really just a working stiff at best.
it's like it says, it's a rags to riches to rags story. But it's a vital story of determination, particularly from the point of view of, you know, the misogynistic, you know, yeah, rock scene and music scene world of business, and then the triumph over all of that at the end of the day. It's a great story because it mostly revolves around their own private, you know, home movies that they shot in high eight around their US and European tours in the early 90s. So it's pretty funny behind the scenes stories there, with Nick Cave's briefly in it as well, and all these kind of backstage shenanigans. That's a great one. Bunch of Kunst, a film about sleeper mods, is a great one as well. Britain is like
if you were on like £15 a week and you turn the telly on and some fucker's spouting on about love, you know, with a guitar in the middle of a forest. Yeah. I mean, that's just shit.
You've heard of Sleeper Mods, or you're familiar with them a little bit, or?
Of course, yeah.
That's a fantastic film. I love the vitality behind that as well. A couple of more unusual ones that are very popular with us is Sun Ra, a Joyful Noise.
I have many names. Some call me Mr. Ra.
Some call me Mr. Ra.
Others call me Mystery.
Others call me Mystery.
You can call me Mr. Mystery.
About the jazz experimental freestyle lunatic whose ensemble is still going to this day, but that's just free jazz, new fusion, bebop, boogie woogie, all sorts of craziness going on in that film, and a lot of people are seeking that one out because they can't find it elsewhere. It's funny, it's very popular even though it was released over 20 years ago, originally shot in the 80s, but it was only on VHS for quite some time. A really funny one, I like, you know, it's always nice to have a bit of humor involved and people not taking themselves too seriously, is something I look out for as well, is Murder in the Front Row. I don't know if you've seen that one, on the San Francisco Bay Area trash metal story.
People have a passion for the metal. There's no distinction between the bands and the fans.
We called it the land of misfit toys.
People in our scene, we felt invincible.
It was about survival. It was like, ah!
Exodus had the destruction recipe.
If Exodus was playing, we were there.
That's Paul Bailoff.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Like, it doesn't take itself too seriously at all. Like, you know, it's all about doing the real, you know, trash metal fans versus the hair metal dudes who are posers and all of that struggle. It seems absolutely ridiculous, like 40 years later, almost 40 years later. But it's a very funny story of, like, the real metal fans versus the dudes who are just trying to look cool and you know, trying to pull girls, like, at the scene. Yeah, that's a great one. Like, it's the foundations of Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, and all that, like, you know, particularly Metallica. So it's interesting to see where the seed of that global rock phenomenon now came from, you know. So the one you mentioned previously, Ambiguity, David Thomas Broughton.
He's a surreal performer.
I like to say that he's like a combination of Richard Thompson and Buster Keaton.
He's terrifying.
Unpredictable.
Difficult.
Erratic.
And somewhat confrontational sometimes.
I mean, I had no idea about him whatsoever until I saw this film. I think that film in particular, stylistically, is beautiful. It puts some really good work into telling a difficult story about a really oddball character. I always like to highlight films that take a different approach to standard, you know, Wikipedia.
I'd never heard of him, but I watched the trailer and I thought, oh, that is definitely one I've got to earmark for a full viewing. He looks like, yeah, quite a character.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He spent some time in North Korea, of all places, working as an English teacher. So he has all sorts of stuff going on in the background that is not directly affected to the music, but really interesting character. Yeah. So yeah, the Gil Scott Heron one as well, Black Wax, is very popular on our channel. That's very difficult to find for some reason. I don't know why, because I know it's available out there elsewhere, but people are flooded in once we started screening that one about a year ago. I think one of the good things about how we built our name over 7 years, that we show up really well on Google and like SEO, you know, in terms of the films might be out there, but we get the first mention of them on the first page, and probably they're out there on the second page elsewhere. We just get a jump on that because of the amount of different screenings we've had over the years. It's kind of reached out into the algorithms that are showing us up more so than others, you know. So that's great. A band called Death's a good one. It's a funny one as well.
Yeah, I've seen that one. That's pretty good. Death by Metal.
And then The Allens, of course, which you mentioned earlier, is a great and I, to say the least, like yourself, I'm not into that scene or that music, and I find it almost difficult to call it music because really it's more performance art, you know. It's not musical, a bit of a whole other game, you know, in terms of it the noise element of it. But that's a great one. I mean, the interaction between his brother and Gigi's brother and their mother, it's just hilarious. It's just brilliant. I love that. It's heartwarming, you know, that kind of thing. Another one, actually, which is our only exclusive title, which as well we're checking out, is Manchester Keeps on Dancing, which is 40-year profile of the beginnings of the dance scene, Chicago house entering Manchester, and Manchester really foisting that in the late 70s, early 80s, onto the scene before London, well, like a good year before London caught on to it, like, and then how that has evolved over the decades, not just from the Hacienda scene itself, but how it's built out from Manchester back into Detroit and back into Chicago and then via Berlin, and how those dots are connected around these music cities, how it's still going strong there in Manchester, you know. It's great. It's got some really good contributors to that story. I'll add one or two to that aren't available on our site that I'd just like to flag. One of my favourites is the Edwin Collins one from Orange Juice, Possibilities Are Endless. Have you seen that one?
Oh, that's a good one, yes. Yeah, I have seen that, yeah.
That's a great one, and that really fits the bill in terms of taking a different approach and not just a bunch of talking heads and archive. It's done beautifully in terms of its dramatic recreation. And Where You're Meant to Be, have you seen that one? That Scottish, what's the guy from Arab Strap? I can't remember his name.
Aidan Moffat. Is it Aidan Moffat?
Following Aidan Moffat, yeah, around the kind of the traditional folk of the 40s, 50s, and 60s of Scottish folk, and how he's got this woman who's big within that scene, and how he's playing around with her life story versus his, and it's a beautiful telling of camaraderie within two completely different scenes, like their whole music scene being an ironic piss take of everything, and her being so sincere about folk music. I think it just works beautifully. That one, and he's such a character. Yeah, that's a great one. We don't have that one either. That's another great one. Then Rude Boy, the Story of Trojan Records.
I've seen that one. That's terrific.
It's beautifully made. I mean, the reconstruction in that, generally, reconstruction is just red flag. No, it's going to just fall flat in its face. And it usually does. I mean, absolutely. In this case, it's an exception that I've seen. Like, I know myself, I can talk to the director. I understand why it's so successful, because they spent over $100,000 on the recreation itself of those dance scenes. Yeah. So, I mean, that was a big budget. That was a BMG film, via Trojan, beyond Trojan. But that's a beautiful film, well worth seeking out. And David Crosby coming out of the same stable. David Crosby, Remember My Name, is the film we screened as well last year. Rude Boy did really well for us as well. And BMG put together a David Crosby film as well. It was well worth checking out. It's him reflecting on the last 50 years of his life and what an absolute asshole he was to the vast majority. Particularly the women, particularly the women, just an absolute prick. And it's kind of his shot at redemption, really, because he knows he doesn't have that many years left. And it's kind of an interesting perspective from that angle. There's some of my favorites, anyway.
Well, we just want to say a huge thank you to you. We'll be putting up links to the website in the show notes when we put this show up. But this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us, Colin.
No worries. Thanks for having me, mate. It's been fun. Cheers.
Thank you.
This is such a great endeavor. And, music documentaries, that's what we do, or part of what we do. So, yeah, it was just a godsend to be able to find you.
Great. Well, I appreciate you reaching out to me. Like, I know I see you have had some Rob Curry and a few other people that I know from the scene have been on your show before. So, it was interesting for me to find you guys as well. So, yeah.
Thanks very much, Colin. Bernie and I will be back in a moment to talk about next month's show, See Here 83. We'll be back in a moment.
Try, you succeed at last. Persecution, you must be. We don't lose the battle, get your sheep. You've got your mind set on.
once again, our huge thanks to Colm Ford of the Dock and Roll Film Festival. We'll put some links up in the show notes for this podcast. Feel free to go search it out if you live in the UK. Please keep an eye out for hopefully when the festival does become a thing again after this nasty COVID bug decides to piss off after we can vaccinate it out into the ether. But in the meantime, they have a lot of fine films on their VOD service, so go check them out. Episode 83 coming to you next month. That'll be March of 2021. As we said at the start of the show, our beloved Tim Merrill is going to be back on the program. He's been working his ass off for the last few months for a career change. He may talk about that on next month's show, but he'll be back and talking with us about music films. So we thought, well, since he's been away for a few months, we thought we'd give him the pleasure of selecting our film for next month. And I had a chat with him yesterday and he said to me he's gone and nominated the film that I've sort of wanted to see for a long while, but it never came into my sphere. I don't think it's on a streaming service and I don't know where the DVD was, but we'll find it. The film is called Black Snake Moan with Samuel L. Jackson and Christina Ricci. So we'll be talking a little bit of blues music and a little bit of chaining up for you on next month's episode of the show. Is it one that you've seen before, Benny?
Do you know, I'm fully aware of it, but like yourself, I've never gotten around to it. So that'll be interesting, two first-timers talking about that. So yeah, that's good.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing that film and very much looking forward to listening to the soundtrack. That was actually how the film came to my attention years ago, was I saw the CD soundtrack and thought, oh, I should buy this, and then didn't, and still haven't seen the film, but it comes with the Tim stamp of approval. So looking forward to talking about that next month. If you wish to join the Facebook group for See Here, you go to facebook.com/groups/See Here. We are part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Our gratitude to them for letting us play in their sandbox. Lots of other wonderful podcasts out there. I think they're up to about 65 different podcasts in their network, and they're all music related. So how good is that? You've got a VOD service to watch your music-related films, and you've got a great podcast network to listen to your music-related podcasts. That's fantastic. If you want to write us an email, seeherepodcast@gmail.com.
Instagram, we are at seeherepodcast. So do follow us there for the occasional pictures and amusing things that I post.
So you'll have some nice dock and roll-related photos this month?
I will, yes, yeah.
So until next month, when Tim returns, look after each other, listen to some great podcasts, listen to some wonderful music, watch some films, music related or not. Just generally be nice to each other, wear masks, hopefully get vaccinated if you're in a part of the world that's started doing it, hasn't started here yet, don't know what they're waiting for. Be nice to each other and look after each other. All the best. Cheers.
Stay safe, everyone. Cheers.
They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. He said, come on, come on, come on, come on, this can't be real.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.